A little bit on the history of the science. We call it now the Science and Technology Advisory Committee. By board action, by the Holden board action, a year ago this last June, this thing was inaugurated. Why don't you come up here? They suggested a group of people that might be the nucleus to start this science committee. And I was gone when they appointed these, so I ended up as chairman. And we've had a very great time. We have a saying that has some scriptural basis that I reminded some of you of yesterday, where two or three are gathered, do we have a science committee meeting. And that's sort of it. We've had many meetings. But before I go any further, I want to introduce the members of the science committee who are here today, and then also tell you some of the others that are on the committee or consultants to the committee, so you'll have some feel for the input into this. I guess I should say that Fritz Norstedt is really, he should be an honorary member of it, because as I told you last night, that it was in 1963 or 4 that we were talking about the future of Holden Village, and he thought that science should have a real input into this, and that it would be a great place for science education, and also that it should address the needs of Holden. And we finally got around to formalizing this. And we serve you through our reports and our work to the Holden Board and the Director of Holden Village, Carol Hinderly. And that's how we serve you. You've already heard from Carol what we're about. And we have here today, on my left, Dave Larson, who is he's a businessman, a CPA, interested in land use problems. And we need somebody who understands economics, look at cost-benefit kind of things. This is very vital to us. And he is today, he's also pinch-hitting for our theologian, because there is a theologian that's a regular member of this committee. Reverend Earl Anderson, and Dave today will summarize a recent report of his to the committee and to our membership. The member on Dave's left is Bill Matheson, who has just joined us, and he, a lot of people were thanking me for bringing Bill, and the truth of the matter is Bill brought me. We flew up, Keith and I and Alice flew up here a couple of days ago, and we're thankful for the bright sun, because we're flying out here in a few hours. And Bill is a physicist and chemist. He was with Douglas Nuclear. He's been in power and energy study in systems and businesses. He has his own business now in Richland, when Douglas left the Hanford complex. And he's involved, among other things, he developed a battery for the pacemaker, and so he's interested in biomedical things, and he's also a licensed engineer, and he serves on some very important committees related to energy and nuclear matters. So he's a great addition to us. I thought of him for this committee, and I thought he'd left Hanford and gone south, and I found out he hadn't. He's a naturalized citizen, having been raised or spent his early days in Canada. So we're happy that Bill is here. And he's been a friend of the village for quite a long time. On my immediate right is Werner Jansen, who works the hardest on this committee. And And we think up a lot of the things, and then he ends up having to do a lot of work. And he thinks up a lot of them, too, but he has to also do much of that work. But sometimes we also do some work. And he, his professional training is aeronautical engineering, and he was with Boeing, and then joined us here. And he, of course, is our chief link with the Forest Service, on whom we must depend by the nature of our operation here. Behind Werner over here is Al Halverson, who is the Extension Service at Washington State University. He is a soil chemist, and you don't have to think very long before you realize that that's pretty important to us here as we are looking at our future here and rehabilitation of the tailings and the analysis of the water coming out of the mine. These are just a few of the things that he's concerned about. He, as I told some of you, he's also, he bakes bread. He's interested in nutritional aspects, partially because perhaps of his good wife, Dorothy, who is a nutritionist and also works for Washington State University. And they periodically send up peas and lentils. And they make good lentil soup up here, probably utilizing some of the recipes of Dorothy, because they do a lot looking at the nutritional aspects of lentils. Now, who are some of the other members? I mentioned Reverend Earl Anderson, Dr. Rudy Edmonds. Well, I should say that Al Halverson, too, very importantly, is on the governor's Energy Council.
Energy Advisory Council.
Yeah, Energy Advisory Council for the state of Washington. Carol mentioned Mike McCormick. Mike McCormick is really Mr. Energy for the Congress of the United States. Happens to be a good friend of many of us. We were co-workers at Hanford Laboratories many years ago. He's also, fortunately, the representative for this district, or for this congressional area. So he is very concerned about Holden. He likes Holden. He and his wife have been here. In fact, they were here for the first meeting of this science council, and they had a lot of input into this. And he would have liked to have been here for our August meeting this year, except the Congress was still in session, and of course he's running again to be our congressman. And he's one of few scientists in Congress today, and he's probably one of the youngest people who has such an important committee assignment as he has in energy in our Congress. He's a very hard-working person, and he asked that I tell the people here how sorry he was that he could not come because of the pressure of these other activities. And he does come up to Chelan a good deal. He has, or I guess somebody, shares a cabin with him down along where that slide is. Pardon? Yeah. So he's really regarded as sort of a member of the committee. Dr. McClellan joined us this last June. Dr. Roger McClellan is one of the authorities of the world on the bioenvironmental impact of energy utilization, not only in the nuclear area, but the hazards of spray kind of things, and looking chiefly at inhalation hazards. And you can imagine that has a great impact on us. He is vice president and director of research education for Loveless Foundation. He's also director of the largest and, I think, the best inhalation laboratory in the world at Albuquerque, New Mexico. Another member I started to mention was Dr. Rudy Edmonds, who's been a friend of the village for, I guess, ever since it started, back in 1960-something. And Rudy is a geologist, and is very much involved in the educational program here in developing the Mine Museum. He was at one time vice president for operations and director of research for the Ohio Oil Company, and then he was returned back to his alma mater at Augustana, and then went down as dean, faculty, and vice president of California Lutheran, which he gave up to be a professor as he's approaching retirement, a professor of geology. A very important member of our committee, a very good head. He was also involved in as a official representative to the very important Habitation Conference in Vancouver this past June. You probably heard about this. It was a very significant conference in our time, and we had a sort of miniature Habitation Conference here then during his stay in August. Realizing that many of you do not realize, perhaps, that as we look at housing the world's population, we have a real challenge, and much of our housing and our living space is very inadequate, and that we're probably scheduled to build during the next 25 years, we're required to build in the next 25 years, as much housing as we did in the past 100. So that's the challenge there, and so this was important to us. And so that's part of our educational enterprise, which I may forget to mention sufficiently here, and that's part of our charge. We also have as a member Larry Collins. Larry and Barbara Collins are very important in the educational input and also theological input here at Holden. Larry is a geologist. He's on, I always forget the name of the university because they changed it down in San Fernando, California State University or something. And he is very well read. He knows geology. He's interested in the mine thing. He's developed a lot of the hiking areas here. He's the Methodist on our board, also on the Holden board, but also an important member of our committee. And he's also, among other things, involved in rehabilitation of prisoners. Some of our members have not yet been here. One of these is Ray Scrindy, who's a hydraulic engineer, at least as a consultant to us. He was supposed to be here for August, and he had a very serious automobile accident. He fortunately walked away. His car was totaled. And he hopes yet to join us. He's a civil engineer and a hydraulic engineer. He's responsible in the U.S. engineers for much of the planning of hydraulic enterprises here in the Northwest. He's educated. His advanced degree was at the University of Iowa. Another person that will be coming up hopefully in mid-October is Dean Carl Hall, who was last year professor. He was president of the Ag Engineering Society of the United States. He's Dean of Engineering at Washington State University. And we want him up here, not only because he's a very knowledgeable person in the energy area, but also he's interested in possibly utilizing some projects here for graduate students in the College of Engineering, some projects that they might do here. And this is important to us, not only having good workers here, knowledgeable, doing things, but also doing it very economically. Dr. Jim Dorn has not been here. He's given feed-in into the committee. He's an engineer in the energy area at Livermore, where he has worked for a long time in positions of responsibility. And he's given us a good deal of information, like on wind generators, which we have investigated, and that type of thing. Who have I forgotten?
Brian Jacobson.
Oh, I forgot Marion. How could I forget Marion? Because Dorothy is up here. She's really sitting in too for Marion. Dr. Marion Jacobson she's retired now. She's a professor of nutrition at Washington State University for many years, and is a very important member of our committee, because we are also looking at your welfare from the standpoint of nutrition, how we might eat better for less, and this is to then help Paul and his associates in the kitchen to answer questions that they might have, and to work with them to help them in their work. They've done a remarkable job of it, and we and you should all be thankful for the great work that is being done in our kitchen. Is that
Meredith Olson?
Oh yeah, I should mention that. Well, I was going to mention Meredith Olson later. She's an aquatic biologist, and we're going to tell you more about that in a little while. She's just finished her advanced training in Puerto Rico, and is now here and developing our efforts in fish. And we'll tell you more about that in a little while. Now, let me just be sure here that I have them all. I have. Now, before we go any further, we're going to turn to Dave Larson, who will summarize the theological aspects of our Science and Technology Advisory Committee.
This August, when we had a meeting up here, one of the summer faculty members, Dale Hayworth, asked me if Pastor Anderson had a background as a scientist. And I said, no, he was appointed to our committee as a theologian. And Dale said, hooray! Every science committee ought to have a theologian attached, and the world would be in much better shape. Of course, Dale, in his inimitable way, asked me, well, Dave, how come you're on the committee? Well, I'm the economist appointed to the committee, and I can assure you that in the Holden hierarchy, that's a lot less important than the kitchen crew. So I was given the assignment of sitting in for Pastor Anderson. He made a presentation to the village in August, and this is summarized from a transcript of his session. He begins by talking about the covenant of creation. In the opening chapter of Genesis, we have the covenant of creation. Now, a covenant is a two-sided agreement where each party agrees to assume and fulfill certain responsibilities to the other. In the covenant of creation, God says, I will be God, and I will provide all that is needed. Now, man, you on your part, your task is to manage. We translate it, and you're familiar with the translation, to subdue or to have dominion. However, the Hebrew word means to caress lovingly. That is, to tenderly manage. Now, every covenant has a sign, and the Sabbath is the sign of this covenant, that one day out of seven is to be a day of rest for man. Now, if you can imagine the Israelites coming out of Egypt, you know, after wandering for 40 years and coming into Palestine, that bleak and barren land that the Canaanites had to work 20 hours a day, 7 days a week in order to eke out a living. And here come the Israelites, and every seventh day they rest and do nothing. And the Canaanites say, well, it won't be long before we foreclose on that property. But it doesn't work that way. And the continued existence of the Hebrews in the Promised Land is the continual sign of the covenant that God provides. And it is only our task to manage, to care for, and to caress lovingly. But what happened to this covenant? Mankind said, no, I'm not going to be the manager of God's creation. I'm going to be the consumer. And here we have the fall into sin, where man selfishly says, I will be like God. And isn't this the essence of sin? When man pretends that all that exists, exists for our purposes. Now, our thesis is this, that there is a purpose for being for all mankind, and that this purpose is the management of all that God has brought into being. Through mankind, all that exists finds meaning and purpose in relationship to God in a very unique way. But in spite of this high calling, mankind has refused to do this and has, instead of being a servant of God, sought to be a consumer, the one who is served. This has forced God to take some pretty drastic measures to bring man into his covenant relationship. Take the story of Noah, for example, where man lost out everything so badly that God wiped out everybody except one family and then said, Noah, do your job. Finally, God had to send his son, Jesus Christ, to restore to us that which was ours from the beginning. And somehow, the redemption that is in Jesus Christ relates to the fulfillment of the covenant that God made with us from the outset. We have done violence to the gospel by making Jesus the savior of our souls, as though souls had value, but that which God has created, the world, the tangible, is of no value at all. Scripture doesn't say that. Such thought reflects Greek philosophical thought more than biblical understanding. As Paul says in Romans, the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the glorious liberty of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning and travailed together until now. Not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait for our adoption as sons, redemption of our bodies. Redemption in Jesus Christ is not pie in the sky by and by. It is not just what is yet to be. In Christ Jesus, God seeks to reestablish a covenant with us. He seeks that we should become servants of God, the managers, you see, fulfilling our role so that all creation can fulfill its destiny and its reasons for being. Pastor Anderson says, over the years I've had a real hard time dealing with the life of God's people in the church as though material substance were a matter of indifference and the intangible entities and feelings were most significant. It is intangible substance that redemption gets in contact with life. Now, if this is true, and I'm rather convinced it is, then we've got a real task to do. Even with all the errors and misconceptions they hold to be true and precious, the so-called Christian peoples of the world for the last 100 years have possessed the majority of the wealth. Why? Is it perhaps that God, having given us this responsibility, then gives this wealth in our hands and says, now people, manage it? If this is true, and we of all people, the people of God redeemed by Jesus Christ, consider ourselves to be consumers rather than managers, we're in trouble. And to me, this message of redemption, this true treasure of the church, is the most relevant word that we could possibly proclaim in our time. I cannot think of anything that is more essential for people to grasp and understand than this. That which they have is theirs to caress lovingly, to manage on behalf of God to whom all belongs, before whom we are all accountable. Since we're talking about our Lord, consider his parables of the talents to be invested, to be used, to be managed. In each case, such use and management is to produce what? It is to produce that which the Master intended. It is not that the creation God entrusts to our care should accomplish what we want, but that it may accomplish that which the one who entrusted it to us intended it to do. And this we consider to be the task of the Scientific Advisory Committee, to caress hold it lovingly, to deal with the questions of the talents, this blight that man has placed on the landscape of God's creation. How can we redeem this fact? How do we handle things like pollution, sewage disposal, solid waste disposal? And we think that this is our charge as managers of Holden Village.
Very good, Dave. The committee has met quite a number of times. We met August a year ago, and then we met, I'm in communication with Werner a great deal and other members of the committee. We met again in June of this last year, in August of this last year, and then again now. Our next meeting will be December 27th here. We're planning a meeting then the following May, probably about May, preparation for the board meetings in early July. We usually have our meetings here. We also, to show you the kind of sacrifices we do make, some of us, some members of the Science Committee, at least once a year and sometimes twice a year, fight the flies and the sun and climb 3 miles from Lucerne to Donkey Lake to check out that as a possible source of water power for us. We keep looking at it every year because you see it's a large water impoundment, and we looking at the possibility of running using that as source of power and having a power plant down near the lake, you see, because you have quite a fall there. That's what we keep looking at. It's incidental that we also catch some fish while we're there. So that shows you the kind of sacrifice we are making for you. And that does bring up one of our chief concerns has to do with the energy. But I thought it would be helpful to you to just to review briefly the basic assumptions by the board for us. Holden Village should be perpetuated for the foreseeable future. In this regard, we assume that the Forest Service will renew our contract, which is a 10-year contract, right? And we have until about 19, we have about 5 years to run. We also assume that the location of Holden Village is not absolutely necessary for its continued existence. That is, it could be relocated somewhere else, such as the deeded property at 25 Mile Creek or some entirely different location. But I think if I read the consensus of the committee properly, they will do everything possible to maintain it here. We also may consider other extensions of it. Number two is that fire risk must be avoided I won't say at all costs, but we go a long way to, we must reduce the risk of fire to the lowest possible denominator. Railroad Creek cannot be polluted. It's a major waterway, it's an important waterway in the state of Washington. Capital improvements should be on our own property whenever possible. Isn't always possible. For some of you who are new, we do not own this land on which our buildings sit. This is leased from the Forest Service. We do own land, somewhere between 150 and 200 acres, up in the mine area and extending down across the river down by the old horse corral, and then extending up on the hill for the mining claims. Holden Village is operated on a labor-intensive rather than capital-intensive basis. We have, we feed them and they work. Sometimes, most of the time. Yeah. Holden labor generally is unskilled and has frequent turnover. Fortunately, the first part may be true for the Science Committee, but we haven't had any turnover yet. Alternatives to fossil fuels must be developed because fossil fuels are a non-renewable resource and they're being depleted at a very rapid rate, and it may not be long before we will be sort of running out of gas. So as good stewards, we must examine that, and also the price will increase. In fact, they may shut off the spigot So we must be prepared for that, because we do heat some of our buildings, and some of our cooking and all is done by fossil fuel. And at the present time, our generating electrical generating system is dependent on water flow from Copper Creek, and it isn't very dependable during a significant part of the year in the winter, at least in some winters, and especially in January to into April. So that certainly restricts then the availability of electric power at that time, and we'll have more to say about that shortly. And another assumption is that balanced diets are necessary for healthful nutrition. This is most important, of course, for staff and faculty staying more than a week. Now, as to some of our activities, we have to, of course, set up priorities. We spend a lot of time thinking about this. And we have to look priority-wise as to, first of all, what may jeopardize our existence here. And a few of these are the disposition of the solid waste, because if we don't have a means for that, it can compromise us. For example, what if we have to haul it all downriver and on barge and go out that way? That becomes a very expensive operation. Sewage treatment. If we don't pass muster there, we can be closed down, or everybody will have to bring their own potty or something and haul it out with them. Or pollution problems involving the tailings. These tailings are bad news. Fuel supply for transportation from the Holden Dock to the village, but also up lake. So these are items that are of great concern to us. Additional projects which are desirable from the standpoint of good stewardship, of course, are energy conservation. We're looking at where can we save energy. And then utilization of the forest, because we are responsible here, and to plant trees. And in that regard, we investigate that. In fact, we're in need of somebody to timber crews right now, because Alex was scheduled to come in October, and now he got a very important and a very desirable job, and it came earlier than he thought. So we have to get somebody else timber crews to see what have we got here that we can utilize for our needs for lumber, for our needs for fuel, and projected needs for fuel here. And also, what kind of trees will do best. And we'd like to get seed cones from this area and then have them raised. And I guess that's underway. The land use. What is the best utilization of the land that we have? And then mine utilization. We have recommended that the mine which is ours perhaps should be opened. Now, this is a project that's going to cost some money, probably $30,000. We do not own the land where the main entry to the mine. We don't own that, but we own the inside of it. So, and we'd rather not have somebody else come in and have a project to say, let's open the mine. For that reason, but for more importantly, we feel that it would be of educational interest to have a safe entry into the mine. It might also be a storage place for much of our material, such as, solid waste, bottles and cans, for example. Might be a good place to save it, because probably in 30 or 40 years, you were younger, we'll be running around the country digging up garbage dumps to salvage these things. And we'll make it easy for you. You can just drive in the mine and haul it out. We're also looking at a source, perhaps of geothermal source of energy. It was reported that way inside the mine, the temperature usually ran about 65 degrees, perhaps. For a long time, the air coming out was 55 degrees, but something has happened. But inside at 65 degrees, well, if you have 65 degrees summer and winter, you can grow things in that. If you have a source of energy with light, you can be growing things in there. So that's of interest to us. We've also looked at the possibility of the mine as a storage area for water and then siphon off for water generation, water power. But that's a little on the back burner right now. But for various reasons, then, we are looking at reopening of the mine. And that's under study. There was a study performed by an engineering company who were looking at the possibility of reopening the mine. They did a study, and we are trying via Dr. Rudy Edmonds to get some of their material. And we're expecting a report from a group on the study now, so we'll have a better appreciation for the cost of that adventure. We're looking also at recycling of products, food production, food sources, and food storage. This is an important area to us. We're looking at food storage in the 25 Mile Creek area, because we have a lot of food given to us, and we want to be in a position for those of you who are very generous and want to do this. We want to be able to accommodate you, so and to preserve that which you give us in the best possible way. So that is, and we have a study, for example, going on land utilization. There's a person or a firm that will, for a very modest price, do a master plan of our holdings at the 25 Mile Creek area as we plan the utilization of that whole area. And this will be done soon. At this point now, let's stop there and go back now and then look at some of these very high priority items that has to do with tailings, sewage and waste disposal, and also energy. Now, as I indicated, we'd like to have a larger and better source of electrical energy. We have looked at the possibility of steam generation using wood from this whole area, and we haven't completely eliminated that as a possibility, but it would be a fantastic undertaking to, of course, collect up all that wood each year. We are still pursuing the possibility of water power. Just to review briefly with you, we have some possible sources here. First of all, we are looking at Copper Creek. Could we dam up Copper Creek way up and run that? Well, that doesn't look very viable. One of the most viable ones we looked at for a while had to do with a dam up on 10 Mile Creek down there. This has a good deal of promise. The Forest Service, however, said, well, look at Railroad Creek. So we looked at Railroad Creek, and there are some exciting possibilities there. And I'd like to have Werner summarize the status of that for you now, because he works very closely with Soley and their engineering firm in Portland. And he talked to a lot of people about this, and we discussed it. So he'll summarize the status of that for you, and also the tailing situation.
And there's two possibilities that we've looked at in terms of Railroad Creek. One is down about 7 miles, and the reason that is attractive is because of the greater elevation difference in a shorter length of pipeline. We could gain maybe 200-300 feet within perhaps a half to three quarters of a mile, and that's desirable from a hydroelectric standpoint. The only problem down there is that we'd have to reestablish power lines, bringing the power back into the village area, and so partially because of the transmission lines, partially because that area would be harder to build a plant in, that the cost would be much greater down there than an alternative that we're looking at, and that is diverting water out of Railroad Creek, forming a reservoir on top of tailings number 2, which is just to the east of us now. It's the one to the east of Copper Creek. The top of tailings number 2 is approximately 40 acres, and there's a possibility that we could establish a reservoir of about 20 acres, maybe 10 foot deep, on top of that tailings pile, diverting water out of Railroad Creek at the same elevation, slightly above, so that gravity would bring the water down to the tailings pond or to the reservoir, and then that would provide a storage. The plant itself would be located at the base of the tailings pile, which is about 130 feet below the top, and of course it would discharge back into Railroad Creek, so again we wouldn't really be taking any water out of Railroad Creek as such, but just diverting it for power use and returning it. With that type of plan, we could potentially get a maximum of about 450 to 500 kilowatts of power. That would be continuous during the summer months when we had plenty of water. It would operate at that capacity during peaks during the winter. During the winter, it may only give a continuous power output of maybe 180 to 200 kilowatts of power. But because of the reservoir capacity, that we could get peak power during the winter of even up to 450 or 500 kilowatts. And that, at the present time, is really the only way that you can store energy outside of the battery. Your water reservoir is the only way you can store electrical energy. And this is, of course, like on all the Columbia projects, you have rather large dams that back up water, tremendous volumes of water, and essentially what they're doing is storing potential electric energy. In our present system, we have no storage capacity. The water runs into a 14-inch pipe. It runs to the plant. There's no way to store it. There's no possibility of establishing a reservoir on Copper Creek. And so we're totally dependent on the instantaneous availability of water in the creek. And that's why during the winter we have a lot of power problems. The other thing that sort of combines into this idea of a reservoir on tailings number two is the whole rehabilitation of the tailings. The Forest Service had a rather thorough study done a year ago on what possibilities there would be within dollar limits that they set on rehabilitating the tailings for a long-term rehabilitation process. And I think they set it about $800,000 as a minimum and something up around $3 million as a maximum. And so this engineering firm did a study as what they could do within these dollar limitations. At the $800,000 level, it appeared as you couldn't do anything that would be of a long-term nature and that would really be worthwhile doing at all. They did come up with a plan that would do more or less a total rehabilitation of tailings number one directly across from us. And this would involve really three things. The first would be the stabilization of the creek bed itself so that in the 50-year flood that they work in terms of planning, that there would be adequate cribbing that would prevent the creek from eroding into the tailing piles and carrying it down Lake Chelan and then into the Columbia. The second thing would be recontouring this first tailings pile so that eventually when the project was all completed, it really wouldn't look any different than the existing mountainside. That may be a little bit far-fetched, but that's sort of the ultimate idea. The third thing, after the contouring would be completed, then they would treat the surface of the tailings with lime, fertilizer, and they would plant it with grasses. The Bureau of Mines has been working the last 4 years. There's some evidence on tailings number one of the really the success that they've had at growing more or less standard grasses that are available, tall wheat grass, crested wheat grass, the fescues. This more or less normal grass will do quite well up there as long as the tailings are adequately treated with lime to neutralize the acid and then fertilizer to give some organic seed for the plant. On tailings number two, it's a little bit different because of the volume of the tailing pile itself. It's going to be virtually impossible to take and start moving around tailings number two. There's no place to move it. It's too close to the creek. Another problem is if you start digging into the berm or the steep side of the tailings that's more or less stabilized over these 20 years, that you're going to potentially cause a lot of pollution just from breaking up the stable condition of the tailings. And so that tailings two and three really become a very difficult problem and a very expensive rehabilitation program. So they would do a minimum there of probably stabilizing the berms with some chemical stabilization, some chemicals that would really just provide or form a film over the surface. And it certainly is vulnerable to erosion, but even some of the chemical stabilization will last pretty well for 5 years. The top of the tailings number two would have a ditch along the toe of the mountain so as to drain off some of the water that comes down from the snowmelt in the spring. Rather than forming pools on top of the surface of the tailings, it would drain it off in the Copper Creek before it would run on the tailings pile. Well, what our thought is the possibility of combining our hydroelectric needs, of building a reservoir on tailings number two, and completing at least a portion of the rehabilitation work that the Forest Service is wanting to do. And in this way, I think the government could save a great deal of money. The tailings would become, I think, more manageable from a pollution standpoint, and we would end up with a hydroelectric project. Hopefully these two could be combined so that the village might save a little bit of money in its work, and the government could save a great deal of money in its work. And so this is about where it sits right now. If the government follows their time schedule, they have I think a $200,000 budget item requested for fiscal year 1978. I always get mixed up on the fiscal year. Is that due in 77 then? In the spring of 77? Yeah. And so that would mean that nothing could come about until next summer on a design. That $200,000 would be for design. And then if that money is granted, then the design would take about a year, which would take us into the summer of 78. And then they would have to wait for project money. And of course, if they contract the entire work, they're talking anywhere, again, from, you know, $750,000 up till $2 million. And that's more than this region for the whole Northwest normally gets for any type of pollution control money. So it would almost have to be a grant from Congress itself to do anything, and this is where the difficulty comes in. That's why they're really looking to us to possibly to become involved in this work and work together with the Forest Service, not as an independent contractor, certainly, because we're not in that business, but really as we sort of team up with the Forest Service and say, well, you know, because we're located right here and we don't have to pay per diem, and we've got a possibility of utilizing, maybe increasing our volunteer workforce, inviting in some heavy equipment operators for a month at a time or a summer, we can do some of that work at much less than what it could be contracted for. And so it's sort of exciting, again, the village becoming involved in that type of work, which is going to save the government a lot of money, potentially get some of our projects completed at the same time for less cost, and solve a very, you know, critical pollution problem for this valley and for Lake Chelan and below.
You should maybe say one or two that we've already had one project like this that was very happy, and that's the dock down there, which got built for much less than it would have cost otherwise. We did the labor, and they provided material, and one of the men, and then of course the ferry service helped also. So it was a joint project, and we're fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mike McCormick thought, in fact, he is definitely, as he could state, indicated that if we were to get involved in a project, that he would have a much easier time getting, you know, governmental money for the project, because you know, any time the government can save money and become involved with private enterprise or with volunteer labor, you know, they really look at those things too. And so if we do get involved, I'm sure the project will get started much sooner than if we wait for the government to independently contract. So this is some of the things we're looking at, but it is sort of a big decision, because it would be a commitment of time and some of our money, certainly, and a lot of energy from the village. Some other projects that we might normally do up here during the summer may suffer for a couple of years. But that's one of the important projects, too, because we live with the difficulty of the pollution. So.
May I ask a question? Would those tailings be any kind of components to make bricks with? Would it be feasible for a kiln to make bricks?
Yes, we've investigated that, and Werner can tell you about that.
Now, there are a couple different processes. One was developed, and I think a few plants are in operation. It was, I think, a process that was, I think Certain Seed Corporation has the license for it, and they've used river silt or ocean silt sand and this type of thing. Anything that has the right, mainly silica combination, can be used for making bricks. The problem here, again, is that if you do it commercially, you've got a tremendous transportation problem. And really, in terms of making bricks over a long period of time, we don't have enough tailings for someone to invest, you know, maybe $1 million in setting up a plant. And then gaining enough money out of it to pay for the investment, because anything from here would have to be shipped to some of the big building centers like Seattle or Spokane. And you know, whether it could compete from a price standpoint is doubtful. And again, there just isn't enough volume of tailings to, you know, to really consider it practical.
The best suggestion we have so far on the utilization of, well, there's been a lot of proposals on utilization tailings. We have utilized them here. For example, in putting in our new water line from from up above down. We would have had to, of course, sift all that dirt because of the rocks. It's a plastic pipe, and you can't have rocks next to it. And instead of going through then the dirt and the sand, we'd lie tailings for that. People have said that, you know, if we would have had everybody that came to Holden take back a sack with them, we'd probably been, you know, a long ways down the road. This last summer, Paul Fanning, those of you who don't know Paul Fanning, you should know him. He's one of the big contributors. He's a Presbyterian. He's a fallen away Lutheran. But he's a great guy, and he has a lot of ideas. Typical of people that left school at 17 and then educated himself and did a better job than most of us did, who spent a lot of time at university. But he suggested that we should use the tailings for what he called the golden Holden egg timer. And you know these things that you make sort of an hourglass, 3, 4, and 5 minutes, you see, and sell them for $5. And everybody who can't come to Holden is guilty about it. They'd be willing to pay $5 for them. And then they'd sell them to their friends, and this would certainly utilize a lot of them. And then he had another idea, which he thought would even go better with all the congregations coming here, was the Golden Holden Sermon Timer. And he thought that it would pretty soon we would be going back into the mine, not to mine copper, but to get tailings to make these things. So we're not short of ideas in certain areas. And we need creativity. So that's... And on the tailings tree, did you mention tailings tree? Then utilizing the water from there, we'd water them to reclaim them too for growth. So that's some of the exciting things in that area that we're working on. And as part of this, you see, we're also looking at the transportation thing, because it takes a lot of gas to go from here to down to the boat. And one of the things we've looked at are electric trolleys, trolley buses such as they have in the city of Seattle, where if we have enough power, we could probably run some trolleys, and one of the possibilities, at least as far as the top of the switchbacks, to get off the hydrocarbon cake as much as possible. We've also looked at solar. In this regard, and it brings me to the educational aspects, some of the educational projects, we did in modifying Lodge 2, and those of you who haven't seen it should see it, the remarkable work that's been done by volunteer labor there, and using lumber that's been cut by our own mill. And it was very cheap lumber because Ernie and Zorban and his co-workers obtained very good deals on this lumber, so you have a very small investment for all the lumber that's in Lodge 2. But in preparing Lodge 2, it was so piped that we can utilize solar panels for heating the water there. And we are also looking at solar heating, maybe for the water, for a shower, perhaps in the sauna area. More and more hikers, the word gets around with hikers. It's just like with bums. I took quite an interest in bums in the old days. The word gets around with bums as to the good place to go. Well, the hikers say, on the trail, drop in a Holden to get a good shower. Well, maybe the best place to do this is down on the river sauna, so we can, not hungry hikers stop at Holden, but dirty hikers stop down to the sauna and they can take a shower there. Well, to utilize solar power to heat some of that. The other thing we're going to do is Al Halverson has a solar stove that he's made, and he's going to have people here make it, and then we'll have a demonstration on frying hamburgers with solar power here one of these times. And it's made very cheaply, and it's a demonstration model. Another way that we might utilize a bit of electricity generated in the so-called Peace Park area, which you should all see, is a water wheel. A good friend of the village and an interesting fellow, still now in his 80s, although he's still sort of 39-ish, He has young ideas in many areas. Herman Propp. And when he was in New Guinea many years ago, he did build a water wheel there for them, which was a source of power for them. And it's also kind of fun. And we'll probably use the raceway water because it has the necessary draw. And we'll get hopefully Forest Service permission to put in this water wheel. We have, I think the lumber has now been cut according to, or the, what we have the lumber available to make this water wheel. And Herman Propp, if everything goes right, will be here probably starting in May to build a water wheel for us up there. And we'll generate at least enough electricity maybe to have some lights out in there, among other things, for the fish pond area. We're very interested in fish, having an area there. Maybe there's people that are getting old like me, or the young ones, to have a place to go and catch fish easily. We mentioned Meredith Olson, who is here, and she has gone into this like a real tigress, I should say. And she is, there's already fish down there now. We're testing out some of the local fish as to whether they can live in the water from Copper Creek, because it has a rather high copper content, as the name indicates. And maybe there's something else in it too. So we have some fish. We have a lot of volunteers who would go out and catch fish to put in there. And one of the things we'd also use maybe electricity for is to have some lamps, lights shining over the pool, and that attracts flies, and then the fish eat the flies, so you don't have to feed the fish anything else. So you can see we're thinking all the time. Another thing on demonstration is now Alice made the recipe, and we're going to have a demonstration a plot right out here with grass growing on it and also flowers, and it's a plot of tailings. It'll be probably a foot deep, and he'll have put some magic into it, and next year Omar, Green Thumb Omar, will have something growing there, which will prove to you that you can grow things on tailings if you have Al Halverson and Omar on your team. You can see what Omar does with this thing. You've never seen any place as beautiful as this. And that's Omar and his associates. So these are some of the educational things. We're also looking at a wind generator, maybe up on the tailings one, to try out, maybe get enough power to pump some water on there to spray around. You can take a walk up on the tailings and see the kind of growth that we have on some of the projects there. So the bell is rung, but these are the kind of things we've done. We're going to put out a want list. If you know somebody that's got a 500 kilowatt generator, or a few miles of 20 or 30 inch steel pipe that's excess, we're in the market for these kind of things. Water generators, and you'll hear about this. And the food. There was a real good suggestion by a nurse this morning. She said, if you've got a lot of Lutheran congregations in the United States following the pattern of Chief, my wife, collecting up aluminum beer cans, they can find out from the Chief, what beer companies put out the best kind of can. She's an authority on this. He's always hot for curds, I know, because they do. But if these congregations all collected up aluminum cans, and if they're not already using them, they can collect up aluminum cans for Holden and just send us the check for having, they don't have to send us the cans. just what they got out of them.
They can send us a check ahead of time and then collect the cans afterwards.
Yeah, that's all right. pay now, collect the cans later. So these are the kind of things that we're interested in. Any other questions? We'll be up around the Vesper Circle up there. And you already know who the Science Committee is. Is there some other member of the Science Committee? I've been hogging the show here.
I have one question. How long is the that generating plants you're going to build, will that meet the projected needs of this place? Is that large? How long is the large plant would it do?
Well, it's sort of a problem around here because I'm sure we could project the needs way beyond that plant, but there's no possibility of really expanding that plant, so we have to sort of, I guess, project our needs or limit our needs to what we can put out. I think that's it all sort of works nice. It's really sort of neat because there are a lot of limitations of the place that sort of go together to keep it a certain size. Like even if we had unlimited power in the winter, we couldn't get people here. So there's no use in having too much power in the winter because we couldn't get the people up the road anyway. So the transportation is a limitation, the power is a limitation, the present facilities are limitations, volunteer labor utilization limits the number of people we can have here. So
it's better than to start another one somewhere else, you see. Mm-hmm. So we sort of look at that. We're also looking at garbage, like we're keeping track. We're collecting a lot of data, like how many bottles in peak times and low times, bottles, cans, this kind of garbage. We're getting quantitative data on this. What is the utilization of power of each of the units of the buildings here? Now there's an architect here looking at the structure of the buildings and what has to be done on the long term with those. So these are the kind of things, we can't talk about all of them, but there's a lot going on here that's very exciting and should be of interest to all those who love Holden. And we're having a very exciting time doing this. And we'll be also putting out some of our need is for talent. And you'll be hearing of that from us.
In thinking about what you said, our task here is to try to preserve the quality of life here at Holden in the future as economically as possible. You mentioned I've been associated with biomedical engineering. There's an associate of mine in Europe, and together we work on an improved pacemaker. And a pacemaker, if anybody has one here, they will know that it not only preserves life in some cases, but in many cases it increases the quality of life. And so this German associate of mine, who's the head of the Department of Biomedical Engineering in Nuremberg, he coined the term that what we did with this pacemaker was our objective was more life at less cost. So if we think of the life in the fullest sense here at home, that might even be a thing here. One of our objectives, more life at less cost.
That can be the theme of the science committee.